You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is American Free Press reporter Pete Papaheraklis. Pete, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Dave. How are you doing today?
I'm good, Pete. Last time we spoke was just recently about your viral Nelson Mandela article entitled The Real Mandela, which, of course, came out in July of this year to very little fanfare. But, of course, after he had passed on this past Thursday, December 5th, the article received an incredible amount of attention, and it's still receiving attention as we speak. Within 2 days after his death on Thursday, December 5th, right before midnight on Saturday, the article had leapt to the number one position on the American Free Press website, where it's remaining and it's still growing. We already discussed that, and we discussed the article specifically, because it was a great article, and there's literally thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of people now who have been turned on to American Free Press because of that article. And then we were just speaking earlier today and discussing some other aspects of Mandela. And of course, the mainstream media is absolutely ignoring everything about Mandela other than what a great guy he was, what a god he was. And he's Mother Teresa. He's a black Mother Teresa. He's a saint. Nothing about the stuff that you brought up in that article about him forming the African National Congress, which was classified as a terrorist organization by not just South Africa, but by the United States and the United Kingdom, about the bombs that were set off, killing innocent people, even one attack on a nuclear power plant. What a bunch of geniuses. And of course, we talked about all this in our previous podcast. And the fella who was with him every step of the way putting this together, this communist Jew, and the fact that communist Jews were behind Mandela from the beginning, and some other aspects of Mandela's life that are, as I said, being completely and absolutely ignored by the Zionist-controlled mainstream media across the world. It's incredible how nobody's saying anything. Of course, I'm not watching it. I don't watch TV, but I'm looking on the internet, and I'm seeing how really there's nothing negative being said. The guy was a god, basically. So now this one aspect of Mandela, I think, would be of great interest to the readers and listeners of American Free Press. And that is the fact that Mandela, throughout his career, he had a very close relationship, not just with communist Jews, but Jews in general. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you tell listeners about that? I guess we can start with that fella, that Lithuanian-born communist Jew. What was that guy's name?
Joe Slovo.
Joe Slovo, right, exactly. And, of course, he had changed his name before he was Joe Slovo or whatever the heck it is, however you say it. A lot of times those Jewish names are hard to pronounce, for me at least.
Yeah, it was a longer name, wasn't it? It was like a three-part name.
Slomo. Yassel Marshall Slovo?
Right.
And why don't you tell listeners about him and about the other involvement with international Jewry?
Yes, I don't know all the details about him. I just know that he became the head of the Communist Party in South Africa, getting funded directly from the Soviet Union. So I don't know if he already was that back in 1961 when he started this with Mandela, or if there was other people involved, but he was definitely given that position at some point in the future. So there were several Jews, apparently, that were working directly with Mandela, because in 1960 or 61, in the 50s, he was already involved in anti-apartheid type of things. I don't know the details too much about that, but he had been arrested already in the 50s and did some time in prison and what have you. But sometime in 1960 or 61, he started working at this farm that was, I think, outside of Johannesburg. And this farm was owned by some communist Jew, don't know his name, Ginsburg, perhaps. And Mandela was working there, pretending that he was a farmhand, that he was doing, gardening and farming, just like several of these guys were. But really, they were making ammunition, they were making bombs and using them to blow up things, like bridges and railway stations and banks and what have you. So the guy that owned this was this Jewish guy, and I think there was maybe like 20 people involved, and half of them were Jews. So Joe Slovo wasn't really an exception, it seems, like the Jews were connected with promoting communism in the country, working for the Soviet Union. I think if you look at the bigger picture there, we see that this was right at the peak of the Cold War, you know, 1960, 61. I guess it was right about the time that we had the Cuban Missile Crisis here. So if you really look at all these countries in Africa, most of these countries gained their independence from Great Britain or France in one way or the other right around that time, in the late 50s, right around 1960. So at that time, probably because of that, it was sort of like a free-for-all to where communism, in trying to recruit all these countries across the world into the Soviet Union, into their program, was looking to, you know, subvert and take power in all these countries. I mean, look at Cuba. When did Cuba become communist?
January 1st, 1959.
Exactly. You see? So the whole world at that time, so it was sort of like a scramble from Vietnam and Southeast Asia and all these countries to Africa, to South America, you know, especially all these third world countries. Oh, and also in Rhodesia, right next door, which eventually did fall to communism. We had Angola, I think, that did become a communist country, right? And Rhodesia became Zimbabwe now, and they have that guy Robert Mugabe, who is a Marxist, ruthless dictator. This was the same thing. The same thing that was happening with Rhodesia was the same thing that was happening with South Africa. So it was Marxism, and being that Karl Marx himself was a Jew, of course, and the whole idea, all of communism and the plan to take over the world through communism was a Jewish idea. The Bolsheviks like Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin arguably were Jews. Trotsky definitely was 100% Jew. Lenin was either half Jew or a quarter Jew from his grandfather. Anyway, and Stalin, his real name was Djugashvili, which means son of the Jew. He was Georgian. Some people say he wasn't a Jew. Others say he was. The thing is, from the 300 commissars of the Bolsheviks, 275 of them were Jews. So,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, it was financed by Jacob Schiff in the United States, gave $20 million. He was the main financier. So whoever cares to look into the Bolshevik Revolution or communism in general, Marxism, all the way back from when Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto, it went hand in hand with Zionism, and it was a Jewish plan from the beginning.
Wow. For some reason, they like communism.
Well, yeah, it was a plan that's been devised for a long time, really. I mean, when you really look at it, it goes back to, you know, the French Revolution. It goes back even before that. You know, it's something that has been in the works, really, for hundreds of years, at least 200-300 years. But officially, it started in 1848 with Karl Marx. So at every level, you see the organized Jewry being behind it. You can't really even understand politics without understanding that, because World War I was really primarily to take down Russia and establish the Soviet Union. And then in World War II, you saw the Soviet Union grow in size to where it absorbed Eastern Europe. And then China also became communist. And then we had, you know, the Korean War was, you know, a product. See, so the Cold War started pretty much at that point, right after World War II, pretty much. So this was a continuation of that plan. I mean, so this was, you know, the bigger plan of how they're going to bring about what they call the New World Order, as we said. So bring it down to size now. This was also happening in South Africa. We touched upon this the last time we spoke, that this was also the same thing that was happening in the United States. So if we look at the civil rights movement in the United States, it has a lot of parallels with Nelson Mandela's story. And again, the Jews were behind Martin Luther King, and the Jews were behind Nelson Mandela. And in both cases, the blacks were portrayed as the victims and the revolutionaries that would, you know, rise up against the oppression of the white establishment. It's the exact same thing. The only difference is that in South Africa, you had a lot more black people than you did in the United States. You know, eventually they have taken over in 1994. In the United States, obviously, they've gained a lot of ground. And the United States, it's not the United States that it used to be back in 1960 or in the 50s when all this started. Certainly, this race issue has taken its toll in the United States and has been used to divide the country along racial lines, as you know.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yes. Well, the common denominator is, again, that the blacks are being portrayed as the victims. And that was the case with Mandela. So when we see today that they're having the funeral and you have so many people attending this funeral, it's mind-blowing. It's surreal. Knowing what we know as far as the crimes that Mandela committed, as far as how many thousands of people were killed on account of him, not only with these acts of terrorism that we have talked about, but then after he was locked up in prison, he was allegedly responsible for tens of thousands of murders, the African National Congress's intimidation to get all the blacks to join them so that they can create a bigger force against the whites. So that was happening while he was in prison. And then once he came out, the ground was set for the ANC to take power. And they let him out of prison, gave him the Nobel Prize. And then all of a sudden, the world rejoiced at what a great achievement this was and made a hero of him. And if you read his story, when they briefly mention all these people that are going to be making speeches, Obama said a few things about him. Other people have already made quotes about him. And they just call him a freedom fighter and somebody that, again, like he was Gandhi or somebody that sort of did the peaceful resistance against racism. So at no point do they say that he was a terrorist and he killed people. Not to mention the tens of thousands of whites that have been brutally murdered and continue to get murdered in South Africa today. That Mandela himself endorsed that and pledged himself to kill all the whites. So that aspect, of course, is not mentioned. And it's just surreal to see people like the Pope there, for instance. Four U.S. presidents. You know, you have not only Obama going there, but you have George W. Bush, you have Bill Clinton, and you have Jimmy Carter. All of them going there. So, I mean, you wonder, like, who is this guy? Who else can you compare? When was the last time all four presidents went to somebody's funeral?
I remember they went to the funeral of the United States when they all got together for NAFTA.
Yeah.
Yeah, bastards.
So with this much adoration from everybody in the world, I mean, there's supposed to be something like 100 heads of state and top dignitaries there. And it's probably going to be, God, they expect 80,000 people at the one stadium where they're going to have the ceremonies or what would you call them, proceedings. But they're going to have three other stadiums, overflow stadiums, where they're going to have huge big screen TVs in order to fit more tens of thousands of people. Who knows how many people are going to be in the streets and in other places. You know, I mean, this is going to be, what they're saying, the biggest funeral since Winston Churchill's time. But is it going to be in the thousands or is it going to be more than a million? I would imagine it'll probably be more than a million people overall showing up. This is all week now that this is going to be going on. It started, I think he died on Thursday and the funeral is going to be on Sunday. So that's 10 full days. I think the official visits and what have you and ceremony started today. So you're going to have from now till Sunday all types of activities going on here. So,
are you going to the funeral?
No, our president is there, though. He went early. I think he went either on Sunday or on Monday. So he's there the whole week. Imagine. I mean, with all the huge responsibilities he has in this country, he still thought it was important enough that he would take a whole week.
All week. Well, you know what? They got some nice golf courses out there in South Africa, so yeah. I'm sure he's going to be on the links. You know, I did see that photograph of him taking a picture of himself. They call that a selfie. Taking a picture of himself with a couple of other heads of state there.
Selfie.
Yeah, a selfie. It was it him and was it the Prime Minister of Denmark? And
the Prime Minister of Great Britain, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he looked really happy. So it's obviously important to the Jewish-controlled media that they portray this guy in this saintly light. Why do you think it is so important for the Zionist-controlled, Jewish-controlled media to do this the way they are?
Well, you know, from my point of view, it's a form of stage magic, really. It's a form of misdirection. It's a form of putting everyone in some type of a trance, really. Because while portraying him as the saint that he is, we don't really see what is really happening, which is the genocide of the white race in South Africa. Since he took over, 70,000 whites have been killed just for being white. You know, the same thing is happening in Rhodesia, Zimbabwe. I mean, whites are being persecuted. It's happening everywhere. So it's portrayed in a way that's designed to sort of appeal to our sense of seeing the blacks in this case as the victim, the oppressed minority that triumphed over the oppression of whites. And it's the same thing that's happening in this country. And Obama is the poster boy for that. He's supposed to be living testament to the dreams of Martin Luther King of equality and what have you. And, you know, finally we have a black president. So what they're promoting is the concept that blacks have been suppressed and victimized for a very long time, and that they've been fighting real hard for several decades now, half a century perhaps, you know, since the civil rights movement and all that. And now they're triumphing. Here's Mandela. He triumphed in 1994 and finally took control of his country. And the evil whites, you know, were displaced, and the blacks took control of their own country. And here we see the same thing, of course, to where blacks keep gaining more ground while whites are basically just apologizing just for existing. So the media is promoting that whole thing. You see the same kind of things. I mean, there's a big group of parallel here with Obama and Mandela. So that's why this Mandela thing is being pushed, because they're making a saint of him. I mean, they're making a Gandhi of him when the guy's really, statistically speaking, he's a mass murderer.
Right. And could we say that the Jews, international Jewry, the Zionist-controlled media, that they are the Wizard of Oz behind the curtain?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You were asking why our article got this much attention, and it's probably because it's one of the few articles out there that says these things. You know, it's like a total blackout out there in order for them to create the illusion that this guy is a saint. So people like us that put out the facts and put out the truth are few and far in between. The alternative media, people that are aware of what's going on, I mean, you can see their comments really a lot of times. If you look at some of these shows and look at the comments, you can see that the people know what's going on, or a lot of the people know what's going on. But the media keeps repeating.
It's relentless. Anything else that can shed light on how it was that Jews had a huge impact on this fellow Mandela?
Well, yes. When people are mesmerized by how great Mandela is in the way that he's presented in the media, one of the key things is that South Africa is about 90% black and 10% white. So in the way that they're portraying Mandela's struggle since he started the African National Congress is that here was a country that was primarily blacks, but the country was being dominated by the minority, who were the whites. And because the whites had all the power and they had the government and the military and all the establishment, if you will, they were brutally oppressing the blacks because they were blacks. In other words, the impression one gets is that the country, South Africa, was always a black country, being that Africa is the black continent. And whites showed up there at some point, most people don't know South Africa's history, and exploited the black people for, you know, hundreds of years. And finally, Mandela came out and the African National Congress and liberated the blacks from this white oppression. Wouldn't you say that that's what most people probably think?
Absolutely, 100%.
Absolutely. Okay, what they don't know, though, is that South Africa was pretty much a completely empty country when the whites showed up there. First of all, black people in general as a population were far fewer than they are today. And blacks were concentrated in Central Africa, areas where there's jungle, really, you know, or it's much warmer, closer to the equator. The fact of the matter is that South Africa had very few, if any, people, and they were just isolated tribes that were very far from one another. So 95% of all the land was basically empty. I mean, even more so than when the British and the colonialists came here to the United States. So these guys, the Boers, were Dutch Protestants that came over there in the 1700s and established colonies. I think they came with a Dutch East India Company that used to go around the Cape of Africa then, of course, from Europe to go to India. So at some point, they needed to get away from persecution from, I don't know, the Catholics or the Europeans. So they ended up establishing a colonies over there. And they cleared the land. They made farms. They made cities. The British eventually came over there at some point. I'm not sure exactly what the interaction there was. I think the British, they colonized the coast and set up cities in the coasts. And they were connected with European banking and merchants and that type of thing. And these guys were farmers, these Boers. So they moved moved further inland. They trekked. They were trekkers. I think that was one of the names that they used. Anyway, so the point is they moved inland to where they pretty much colonized the heartland, not just the coast. So these things took, I don't know, a couple hundred years or so. In all this time, there was no blacks there. There was blacks in some isolated places, but in the whole country, maybe there was, I don't know, a few hundred thousand or tens of thousands. Very few from what I read in the history. When things really started to change is when this guy named Cecil Rhodes came down there, maybe in the late 1800s. And Rhodes is the guy that Rhodesia is named after, which is now Zimbabwe. And this was part of British colonialism. And this guy came over there in order to dominate the country for the British and set up the De Beers Diamond Mining Company. That's what sort of changed everything around. After him was this other guy named Oppenheimer, a Jew. I don't think Rhodes was a Jew, but this guy Oppenheimer, he was a German Jew that came there through Britain and really turned this place into like the diamond capital of the world. And that's where the blacks came in. See, up to that point, there wasn't hardly any blacks in South Africa. So they started coming from further north, from Rhodesia and from, I'm not sure exactly what other bordering countries are there. And they started moving down because there was actually work. Before that, there was nothing else where they would get money or be able to make a living. There was no industry in any of these other countries. So that's really what happened. So De Beers Company was a brutal, brutal company that utilized tens and hundreds of thousands of blacks and just basically worked them to death there with very little pay and very bad conditions. So if there was any exploitation of the blacks, if exploitation is the right word, because they came voluntarily from a different place to the mines in order to work. So it's not like somebody went there to enslave them. They came for work. But I'm sure there was some exploitation, harsh treatment and all that. But, you know, the blacks that came there to work in the mines, they ended up staying there because there was other things to do there as far as work. And eventually they grew. I don't know the details, but I mean, 100 years ago, let's say, there was probably maybe 5% black in South Africa, you see, 120 years ago. So it wasn't like this was always an established black area that the whites went and took over. So that's a huge misconception. So when we see that the blacks are 90% of the population, well, that's because they've multiplied. That's because a lot more of them have come down from the northern areas. It's not because they were always there. And we'll probably be seeing a lot more of that in our country and in Europe. I remember when I was going to school here, when I was younger, you know, blacks were 6% of the population. Now they're 12% of the population. Blacks around the world were only 9% of the population in 1950. Now they're about 15, 16% of the population, if not more. So they've doubled in general, whereas whites, because they don't have as many children, whereas blacks and other races multiply a lot more, you know, you're getting a lot of this type of phenomenon to where blacks are just multiplying a lot more.
You're just talking about fertility rates, that's all.
Exactly. Right. This has been happening, again, I'm not sure exactly how this happened throughout the 20th century, but it went from where blacks were a very small minority of the population to where they moved in and now have dominated and have taken over. So when we talk about the apartheid government, it's presented as the whites having gone there and exploiting the blacks. Well, the whites built all this stuff. This was the white cities that had been there long before the blacks ever came there.
But what about the Jews now? They're generally not considered white, right?
Well, it depends who you ask. They look white, don't they? They have maybe certain characteristics, but you can't say, oh, this guy's definitely a Jew or that guy's definitely a Jew. So you can't say they're black on the most part. They're not Oriental.
They're like Asiatic, right?
Well, yeah, but the Asiatics are also white, aren't they? So I guess what I'm saying is from an anthropology point of view, they probably will be classified as white. But, well, traditionally, they were a Semitic race, which is not white. Now, as far as the Khazars, I guess they were white. Maybe you could say that they came from Mongolian ancestry.
Right.
I don't know the details of it. Yeah, they're Asiatic, but Putin is Asiatic. You can't say that Putin is not white, right? well, Moscow is not in Asia, but most of Russia is in Asia, and it's got, you know, a lot of white people. You can't say that they're not white. So I don't know where you draw the line. The point is they are white in the sense that they are not black, and they're not Indians, and they're not Orientals, but they're unique race, I guess, sub-race, you know, to where the Jews, they stick with each other. They have their own religion, but they're more than a religion. I mean, racially, there's a specific look to most Jews, and they try to not mix their blood with other people as much as they can, and they're very ethnocentric. I think people don't make that distinction to where, so the blacks, for instance, if they were abused by the De Beers mining company and have a chip on their shoulder because they got abused like that, they don't know the difference to say, oh, it was the Jews that abused us. They see all whites as the same, in the same way that us whites maybe wouldn't distinguish between a black that's from, I don't know, Somalia and a black that's from Nigeria. We would say, well, they're blacks. They're not the same thing.
So how much of a part did the Jews play in the exploitation of the blacks in white-created South Africa?
I would say they played all the difference, because the diamond mines and I guess the gold mines and everything, they were the biggest game in town. Those were the industries that needed hundreds of thousands of people, because you're just digging through tons and tons and tons and tons of dirt.
So the Jews controlled those?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Definitely. The De Beers Mining Company was, I think it was started by Cecil Rhodes, but it was hugely expanded by Oppenheimer, who was a German Jew that had become an English citizen.
It seems like they still do control the diamond.
Apparently they controlled everything. I've known some friends from South Africa and we're talking, and the name Oppenheimer just kept coming up over and over. I mean, they basically ran South Africa at some point. I'm sure that they expanded a lot of other industries more than the diamond industry, but that's what provided the initial power structure for them. So they probably bought everything at some point, you know, or they bought a lot of the bigger industries and the banking, as they usually dominate.
And the beat goes on.
And the beat goes on. You could, again, make a parallel with the United States, because here in South Africa, you had the whites that were living with some kind of harmony between themselves. There was friction between the Dutch and the English. But here come the Jews, and then their greed basically gets the best of them in this case. The Oppenheimers, anyway. I'm not trying to say that all the Jews are greedy. I'm just saying that a lot of these top banking types certainly are. And the Oppenheimers were certainly no exception. So they come in. And then they bring in blacks as slave labor or real cheap labor, exploit them and everything. And then, because they end up owning the media and the politicians and what have you, then start twisting things around. And then they get the blacks to hate the non-Jewish whites, who had nothing to do with any type of exploitation. And then they come out smelling like roses, the Jews. And then if you look in the United States, you have the same thing. I mean, you know as well as I do that the Jews ran the slave trade in the 1600s and the 1700s. And that the Jews were the ones that brought the black slaves over here. And of course, that they were already slaves to their own black slave masters in Africa. So the whites, in essence, had absolutely nothing to do with bringing the slaves here. Even secondhand, even the people that bought the slaves at the auctions, once they came off the slave ships, also were Jews. And then they sold them to whites. Only 1% of whites had slaves in America, just the big plantation owners down south that accounted for only 1% of the population. Yet today, we have this huge white guilt that has been developed by the Jewish media and brainwashing and everything that we've sort of gone through since the 50s and the civil rights movement. And every white is supposed to feel real terrible about what they did to the blacks. And the blacks hate us because of what we allegedly did to them. And in essence, we didn't do anything to them. The Jewish slave owners took the blacks from black slavery in Africa and brought them here. And we liberated them. The whites, in essence, if you really look at it, the whites were the first to liberate the slaves. Everybody had slaves back then. The Turks had slaves, the Arabs, Muslims had slaves, the Chinese had slaves, the Africans had slaves. Everybody had slaves. We liberated them. 700,000 white people got killed in order to liberate the blacks here during the Civil War.
And they appreciate it.
So the reality is that the Jews were involved in bringing them here, just like they were involved in bringing them into South Africa. But then they turn around and start getting the blacks to hate the whites and getting the whites to hate the blacks and create all these racial tensions, when really there wouldn't have been any if these people had never gotten forcibly put together like that.
And they're still doing that today, creating the racial tensions.
So they created the racial tensions, they put the demographics there in place, and then Mandela steps in, and this was the time that they started this, oh, you know, boo-hoo, boo-hoo, look what happened to the poor blacks because the whites are exploiting them. And as a result of that Marxist, communist type of equal rights revolutions that they've been fostering, the blacks finally took over South Africa. And look at what's happened to South Africa. It's gone. It's finished.
It's a disaster.
It's a disaster. And look what's happening to the whites in South Africa. And I'll tell you what, I'm afraid to even think of what's going to happen now that Mandela is gone. I read a quote somewhere that was said by a high official of South Africa that said, just wait till Mandela dies. The whites are going to be killed like flies. Something to that effect. I had it written somewhere. So for some reason, as bad as he was probably still, Mandela that is, at this point, because they've made such a symbol out of him, he was probably still some type of a stabilizing force. I'm afraid that now that he's gone, although we're looking at his legacy and what he's done and it's pretty bad, I'm wondering how things are going to be once the funeral is over and all the hoopla. Because you know as well as I do that the current prime minister goes on TV and gets in front of stadiums and encourages the blacks to go out and kill as many whites as they can.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
So I'm wondering what's going to happen with that now.
So they might have been correct, or they might be correct in praising Mandela because he held the blacks back from taking their machetes out and chopping all the whites down.
I don't know. Maybe he did, at least at this point. Not in the beginning, not when he came out of prison, he didn't, for sure. He encouraged the blacks to take their machetes out at that point.
Pete, thanks again for writing the article. Thanks again for taking the time out the other day in our interview. And thanks again for taking the time out for this interview, educating the listeners, and looking forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you very much.